You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. On this episode, local bookseller and journalist Caitlin Gleeson speaks to Ben Crabe, author of new young adult novel Love is the Answer. I dissect the Women's Prize shortlist with local book fanatic Laura Mugbridge, talk all things graphic novels with Brighton-based artist and author of Coma, Zoe Slattery, and I talk to Heidi James, writer of this month's book club book, Wounding.
So today I'm joined by Ben Crabe, whose new young adult novel, Love is the Answer, was released in July this year. As a writer of play scripts for over 10 years, this is his debut into the fiction world. Thank you for joining me today, Ben.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So tell us about the premise of your book.
So it's a edgy, dark romance set against the background of grief, really. Love is the Answer is about a 17-year-old girl. She's lost her mum. She's discombobulated with that. Her life's turned upside down, and she meets a very talented, equally kind of messed up aspiring DJ, and they have a kind of wild and slightly reckless and crazy love affair, and they go off the rails and it kind of comes crashing down. And maybe he's the kind of guy that if you said to your friends, should I go out with this guy, they might say no, but she kind of does it anyway. She dives right in.
Right. And so Scarlett, as you say, is sort of going through mental health issues. What kind of research or observations did you undertake in order to represent the experience of her trauma?
So the themes are themes really close to my life in that I lost a parent really young. I didn't lose my mum like her. I lost my dad at 21. So in terms of knowing what it was like to have things turned upside down, to feel, because not many young people, it doesn't happen to many young people, it happens to quite a few, but not that many. You feel different to all your peers. You feel like you're kind of in another dimension to them. And the whole thing of that sort of mad, edgy love thing and partying, the person she falls in love with is a DJ and introduces her to the world of clubbing and partying. And, you know, I definitely know from experience that, you know, when you're vulnerable and when you're feeling, you know, when life is super hard and maybe life is just hard, you know, partying and drugs and stuff, they're most seductive because they offer like one time when you feel all right in a way. You know, and I guess what I'm saying is like a lot of the themes in the book have been close to my life, either myself or people close to me. But like, it's not autobiographical, like literally, you know, that's the stuff in the book happened to me, but the themes are close to my heart. So in that sense, I knew the material, but in terms of getting it right, I had to do research. Like if I'm writing about the clubbing world in the late 2010s, I just had to make sure, I had to research that, get the details right, get the kind of venues right. Yeah. Kind of the shape of it, because when I grew up, clubbing was really mainstream and DJs were mega celebrities, and it was this sort of, it was everywhere. Like young people wanted to be a DJ, that's what they wanted to do, and it's not quite like that anymore. It's people still do, but it's not as mainstream, it's not as big, but it's still going on. So I just had to really make sure I got those details right, really.
Absolutely. I was just going to say, you know, drawing upon those themes without, you know, giving too much away, there must have been challenging things to write. What do you think was the most challenging part for you to write in the book?
The most challenging thing for me to write in Love is the Answer was, there might have been two things. There was one, Scarlett going clubbing with this boyfriend and having a transcendent sort of aha moment. Lots of people have that when they first got into clubbing and they kind of realize what it was about, and the music and the energy and the kind of almost evangelical sort of aha moment. That felt really emotional to write and tough to write. And also the scenes when she really remembers her mum, goes deep into her grief for her mum, that was tough to write. I had to dig deep because it had to feel authentic as I could get it, and real, and sort of, but that was sort of a hard thing to mine down to get.
And so you've talked briefly about her and the relationship with this troublesome young guy. What interpretation do you hope that readers take away from their relationship?
What I really hope, I hope that readers live it like she lives it. You know, I hope they feel where she is, understand where she's going from, even though she might make choices which no one would advise anyone to make. They kind of feel the compassion and they feel, go through that big journey with her. I want them to be able to explore the dark depth that she goes to, and like the kind of how she sails close to the edge. But I also want them to get, I'm really interested in how sometimes in our darkest times or our most difficult things that we do, like there's something really valuable and special comes out of them. And so it's really easy to just like divide life into good and bad and say, oh, that thing I did, that was bad, I don't want to do that anymore. Or that thing, that's good, I want to do that. But sometimes, you know, I wouldn't recommend anyone to do what she does. I wouldn't like a prescription. But it's like one of those funny, mysterious things about life is sometimes in the kind of the tough experiences, something new and fresh and golden, and there's some kind of benefit from it, something that you take away from it that you'll never lose, that will hand you in good stead for the rest of your life. So, you know, I've said a lot of things. I've said it sounds like a really sad book, but it's not bleak, and I don't want it to be bleak. I hope ultimately it's, I don't want to use the word uplifting, but maybe uplifting is the best word I can think of right now.
Yeah, that there's something beneficial to take away for readers.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you said in a previous interview, obviously you're talking about clubbing and DJing and music being a huge part of the book. Said in another interview that when you were a teenager, music was, and I quote, so important to me, it was almost like a life or death issue. Yeah. While you were writing, were you listening to what fueled you creatively or what you thought Scarlett would be listening to at the time?
I loved listening to music while writing. Yeah. Love is the answer. It was, I was listening. I wanted to find contemporary songs. This is a song about a contemporary person, contemporary teenager. So I wanted to find contemporary dance music, contemporary song. And I just had a blast. I love music. And my experience being young, someone said to me this just today. They said, like, certain songs, certain singers, when they were a teenager, and like, I agree with this, it's like only they understand. It's like, nothing else in the world understands apart from that song that encapsulates something that you feel, or they get it in a way that nothing else does.
Yeah, absolutely.
I listened to loads of dance music, had loads of YouTube live streams on, researching loads of DJs and you know, watching what they do, and I really enjoyed that. And that was about, yeah, capturing the flavor of the music in the book as well, but also it's just fun for me. But I also listened to a lot of sad songs, a lot of heartbreak songs, like a lot of amazing young women singers. There's a singer called Banks, who's an American singer, and like her, yeah. You know, she sings like very raw, very painful songs, but she does it with so much spirit and energy and sort of attitude. And she's also like very fragile, very passionate, and that was kind of something I was trying to aim to capture. And quite a few other groups as well. So yeah, I had a Spotify playlist of songs I listened to as I did it. And like, as I finished the book, I kind of distilled it down to like the 10 songs which I felt best captured the flavor of the book.
Fantastic. I mean, most authors have playlists that they listen to, but it sounds like it was really like a mainstream part of your writing process. You started writing this novel from the perspective of an 18-year-old. What novel had a formative influence on you at that age?
This was, I struggled to think about this for a while. I think there was one novel that was really powerful for me, because I, you know, when I was about 18/19, that was possibly a very difficult and challenging time of my life. In a way, it was one of the saddest times. And I remember reading the novel Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Love in the Time of Cholera.
Yeah.
And part of the basic premise is unrequited love. It's about a man who falls in love with a woman and then she marries someone else. And he basically stays in love with her for his whole life, and he doesn't stop feeling any less passion. And then almost in their 70s or 80s, almost like the last page, he gets together with her. And right. I think the last line is something like, I'm not going to say it as good as it's written, but how long are you willing to wait? And he says something like forever or something. And I just, I don't know if I can put into words why it moved me so much, but I was reading it. I was traveling in Italy at the time, and I was in some restaurant having lunch, and I just burst into tears. And I just remember walking down the street in Italy crying. Yeah. It was like really, really moving. And I love it because it was about, you know, it's feelings, it's people, it's heart stuff. It's the kind of stuff I like to write about. And it's that, you know, that inspires me, because those are the books that I value, the ones that move me, the ones that like really pull at my heartstrings, you know, make me laugh, make me cry. Those are the ones I love.
Absolutely. I think most people can relate to that. You know, you're reading a book and you read something so powerful that it just absolutely shocks you. Speaking of reading, it would be fantastic for our listeners to hear part of Love is the Answer if you'd like to read us something.
Sure. I'd like to read the very first chapter. It's actually kind of prelude. It's called Before. And it's a scene, the only scene with Scarlett and her mum. And it's when her mum's ill and she's still alive. Before. I just think it's never going to happen. I scrape the drops of hot chocolate and bits of froth from the bottom of my cup. Mum's made an effort to dress cute with a denim jacket over the hospital gown. Why is it so easy for everyone else and not me? It's like there's being single and being in a relationship and this long rope bridge between them running across this giant ravine. And they're all like walking across, singing and whistling, la-di-da-di-da. And I'm like, there is no bridge, just a massive 10-mile drop onto razor-sharp rocks. And I'm standing here with my binoculars, watching them make out and be coupley, and I've had enough. It's only a matter of time, she says. I'm sick of it. Mum smiles and winces at the same time. She reaches into her handbag, removes her debit card, and places it on the bill. Maybe this is a way of distracting herself from what is going on with me, she says, holding out her hand. I take it and slide my fingers in between hers. I've always been like this, like I'm never going to get close to anyone. But I'm always going to have a label on me, like Scarlett has the plague, don't touch. I laugh. She laughs. I'm serious though. You know what I feel like when there's no hope? What? I go to the chapel. I scowl. It's not because I've turned religious. It's on the top floor. It's got the best view of the whole of London. I spoon the remaining froth into my mouth. It tastes burnt. Seeing the lay of the land always makes me feel better. Thanks, Mum. Just have some fun. The last time I had fun was at a party with a random called Gavin who kissed like a Labrador at dinner time. Done that, I say. I hate it. The waitress arrives and makes a theatrical show of shoving the card in our faces so we can see she's entered the correct amount. The machine beeps, she rips off the receipt, hands it to my mum, and she's gone. We walk arm in arm through the corridor and back to her ward. Shouldn't be talking about myself, I say. I'm being totally selfish. We wash our hands with antibacterial gunk while we wait to be buzzed in. I'm sorry. I will be here for you, to listen to you, to support you till my very last breath, even if my legs and arms are chopped off. Like the knight in Monty Python and the Holy Grail, who carries on fighting even though he's basically dead and can't move, I say. We laugh. I walk her through the ward and help her into bed. I hate the screens, the wires, the drip connector in her arm, the ridiculous amount of pills in a cup by her bed. I watch her put her headphones on and open the Classic FM app. She says music keeps her sane in here. I love you so much, I say. I love you too. And Scarlett, when you know, you'll know. Thanks, Mum. See you tomorrow. Sure. I squeeze back my tears and walk out of the ward.
Thank you for reading that to us. That was fantastic. Before we end today, our question we always love to ask local authors is, you are a local author. What do you enjoy most about living in Brighton? And is there an aspect of it that fuels you the most creatively?
Brighton is an amazing place to be a writer. Like, one thing is full of writers. Like, they kind of seem to be everywhere. Not just like if you go into the bookshops, there's lots of local Brighton authors, with their books on, you know, sale. But I just see them everywhere. Like, I don't know if they're published or not. I just see people writing fiction, writing scripts. Like everywhere I go, it's like I can clock them in a cafe. You're always going to know. So there's this real, I don't know, creative energy, and it's a really creative town. It's not just writers, it's artists, entrepreneurs, people starting their own business, and lots of independent, small kind of individuals or very small companies. So it's got this kind of really buzzing, independent, creative kind of vibe about it, which I really enjoy.
Absolutely.
I like, you know, I'm writing, at the moment I'm writing a lot about London, and I get a bit of perspective here from London, and that helps with the writing. But, you know, and there's all the other stuff, like, it's, you know, the sea, you know, being able to go to the sea and sit on the beach whenever you want and connect with the sea. And it's you know, what is it? It's spiritual, it's therapeutic, it's relaxing, it's moving. And then you've also got, you know, all the amazing food, drinks, you know, I mean, it's an amazing place.
Absolutely. I think, you know, everybody who lives here would agree with you. Thank you so much for being on the show today, Ben. It's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you. And we will catch up with you, I'm sure, at some stage in the future.
Thank you so much.
Friend of the show and avid reader Laura Mugridge gave herself the challenge of reading the Women's Prize for Fiction shortlist this year. Now, we know that Susanna Clarke's Piranesi won, but what did Laura make of the Six Strong shortlist? And was Clarke's book a deserved winner? Laura, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, it's nice to be back again.
Overall, was this a good year for the Women's Prize for Fiction?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I slightly accidentally set myself the challenge in that I'd read three of them, and then I suddenly knew there was a deadline. So I was like, well, I should read them all then, shouldn't I? So yeah, I mean, I thought they're all really brilliant. And when I think about them, I have very vivid images in my mind, which I think is one of the things they were looking for, something that a piece of work that would make a difference, that would feel different and original and unique. And they all really do.
That is wonderful to hear. So what we're going to do is go through the Six Strong shortlist. I'm going to ask you to read the blurbs. We'll talk a bit about them, what you thought of them. And then at the end, I'm going to ask you for your top three if you were the sole judge of the Women's Prize for Fiction. So let's start with Britt Bennett's The Vanishing Half.
Twins, inseparable as children, ultimately choose to live in two very different worlds, one black and one white. Davinia's sisters will always be identical, but after growing up together in a small southern black community and running away at age 16, it's not just the shape of their daily lives that is different as adults. It's everything, including their racial identities. Many years later, one sister lives with her black daughter in the same southern town she once tried to escape. Across the country, the other secretly passes for white, and her white husband knows nothing of her past. Still, although separated by so many miles and just as many lies, the fates of the twins remain intertwined. What will happen when their own daughter's storylines intersect?
I personally have read this book and absolutely loved it. What did you think of it, Laura?
I loved it. And this is one of the ones that I read when I wasn't doing my challenge. So I just loved it. I feel, when, again, like as I said about all of the books, actually, when I think about this book, there is one particular character that really sticks with me, and it's the character of the woman who stays in the community, the way that she forges her own path and her own identity. I think she was the most interesting character of the book, but I loved it. I just think the setting was really vivid. And yeah, when I think about it, I'm back there again, which I love in a book.
Absolutely, absolutely right. Let's move on to number two, which we're going to do Claire Fuller's Unsettled Ground. Now, I haven't read this, but I really like Claire Fuller's writing and read Our Endless Number Days a few years ago. I've also met her, and she is one of the nicest authors I've ever met in person. So I'd love for you to read the blurb of Unsettled Ground, Dora, and tell us what you thought about it.
Twins Jeannie and Julius have always been different from other people. At 51 years old, they still live with their mother, Dot, in rural isolation and poverty. Inside the walls of their old cottage, they make music, and in the garden, they grow and sometimes kill everything they need for sustenance. But when Dot dies suddenly, threats to their livelihood start raining down. Jeannie and Julius would do anything to preserve their small sanctuary against the perils of the outside world, even as their mother's secrets begin to unravel, putting everything they thought they knew about their lives at stake.
So we've got more twins here.
More twins.
Yeah, in a very, very different way. What did you think of Unsettled Ground, Laura?
This was a book that I ended up reading. I read in the bath till it went cold. I don't normally read late at night, but I couldn't stop reading this one. I was excited to get back to it. I took it away with me when I was working quite intensely, and I would get back from quite a uh, a tricky day. I was working with lots of children, which was great fun, but, you know, pretty intense. And I just couldn't wait to open this book again. And I, and for me, that's, if I'm reading at night instead of watching telly, that's a really big indication of how much I liked it.
Excellent. Right, let's move on to Yar Ghazi's Transcendent Kingdom.
As a child, Gifty would ask her parents to tell the story of their journey from Ghana to Alabama, seeking escape in myths of heroism and romance. When her father and brother succumb to the hard reality of immigrant life in the American South, their family of four becomes two, and the life Gifty dreamed of slips away. Years later, desperate to understand the addiction that destroyed her brother's life, she turns to science for answers. But when her mother comes to stay, Gifty soon learns that the roots of their tangled traumas reach further than she ever thought. Tracing her family's story through continents and generations will take her deep into the dark heart of modern America.
So we've got more family secrets in this one, especially after family members have died. It's really interesting thinking about them like this and seeing what the common themes are. How did you find Transcendent Kingdom, Laura?
I found it a little trickier, I think, to get into. For me, there wasn't as driving a narrative as perhaps some of the other books. I found there wasn't a character I could latch onto quite as easily. I still thought it was brilliant. And I know this is a ridiculous thing to say, but the cover is so beautiful.
The colours, the green and pink.
Green and pink. I know that's, we shouldn't really be judging. Like they say, you shouldn't be judging a book by its cover, but it is quite something. So I enjoyed it. I read it quite quickly. So I was, you know, I was engaged, but I just found it a little bit, maybe it's just I didn't latch on to any particular character. I found it, it's not a laugh a minute, but I mean, I like books. I do generally like quite bleak books. But I think, yeah, I don't know. I struggled a little bit with this one.
Okay. Fine. So let's move on to, and I love this title, and I hadn't heard of this book for my sins before it was on the shortlist, but we're going to move on to Cherry Jones's How the One-Armed Sister Sweeps Her House. Can you read this blurb, please, Laura?
In Baxter's Beach, Barbados, Lala's grandmother, Wilma, tells the story of the One-Armed Sister, a cautionary tale about what happens to girls who disobey their mothers. For Wilma, it's the story of a willful adventurer who ignores the warnings of those around her and suffers as a result. When Lala grows up, she sees it offers hope of life after losing a baby in the most terrible of circumstances and marrying the wrong man. And Mira Wallen, it's about keeping alive, trying to make sense of the fact that her husband has been murdered and she didn't get the chance to tell him that she loved him after all. How the One-Armed Sister Sweeps Her House is the powerful, intense story of three marriages and of a beautiful island paradise where, beyond the white sand beaches and the wealthy tourists, lies poverty, menacing violence, and the story of the sacrifices some women make to survive.
It sounds wonderful, but it also sounds like there's a lot going on in this book with the three narratives. How did this work for you? Did you enjoy it?
I loved it. It's very filmic. I could really, really imagine it being made into a film. The setting is very vivid, and it didn't. I know it sound like the fact that it's about three marriages. It didn't ever at any point feel complicated. And again, I read this quite quickly, and it was again very vivid. I loved it.
And I love Caribbean settings in books. I find they can often just be so immersive. Was that done well by the author?
Oh, it's done beautifully. I think out of all of them, the place is represented in the best way, actually, out of all the books.
Wonderful. Well, that's definitely bumped its way up on my to-read pile. Thank you very much. Well, so next book, our penultimate one. I have heard really mixed thoughts about Patricia Lockwood's No One Is Talking About This from my friends and colleagues. And I would love to know, firstly, what it's about, but secondly, what you thought of it.
A woman known for her viral social media post travels the world speaking to her adoring fans, her entire existence overwhelmed by the internet, or what she terms the portal. Are we in hell? The people of the portal ask themselves. Are we all just going to keep doing this until we die? Suddenly, two texts from her mother pierce the fray. Something has gone wrong, and how soon can you get here? As real life and its stakes collide with the increasing absurdity of the portal, the woman confronts a world that seems to contain both an abundance of proof that there is goodness, empathy, and justice in the universe, and a deluge of evidence to the contrary.
So is this a kind of slightly sci-fi element to this book, Laura, would you say?
No. I wouldn't say, actually, but maybe that's because I've interpreted it wrong. No, it's kind of written, for me, it's written like an Instagram feed.
Right, okay.
So it's in small chunks, in small paragraphs. There's some sections that are like reading a text conversation, and it's written, there's no... I don't think there's any pages that are just full of text. So it's written in that kind of bite-size format of something that you would indulge in, like, you know, look through a feed in the morning or, yeah. So it's quite difficult to get into, but I wonder if that's the point. Like there's sections of it that it sometimes felt quite jarring. But I don't think that was, I don't think that's a problem with it. I think that's what it's trying to do. It was the first one I read, I think, of the collection, of the shortlist. So it's the one I read the longest ago. But I enjoyed it, but I was never completely immersed in it, I don't think, because of the way in which it's written.
Is it a kind of satire on social media?
I think so. Yeah, I think it presents it as something quite damaging, but it's also the only way in which this woman knows how to survive. And I think there's quite a lot of people reading it who might feel the same about it. Certainly it made me question that kind of shallowness of it. But then something quite dramatic happens that sort of puts that all into perspective a bit, but it also sort of doesn't. Like, she does still continue to use the portal, as she calls it, despite this huge event that's happened, which unfolds in quite a subtle way. So I liked that about it, that it wasn't it didn't hurry through it. That was quite delicately sprinkled, and then it gets more apparent as the book progresses.
It sounds really intriguing, and one of those books that's actually quite hard to describe, and really you should just read it if you need to know about it.
Yeah, I think so. I think it is quite hard to describe, and I think that's one of the reasons why it's on the shortlist, because it is very different. I've not read anything like it.
Right, so we move on to our final book, and this is the book that won the 2021 Women's Prize for Fiction, which is Susanna Clarke's Piranesi. Again, to my shame, I didn't even know about this book before I saw it on the long list and then the short list. So I'm really, really looking forward to hearing what it's about and hearing what you thought, Laura. So can you read the blurb, please?
Piranesi lives in the house. Perhaps he always has. In his notebooks, day after day, he makes a clear and careful record of its wonders. The labyrinth of halls, the thousands upon thousands of statues, the tides which thunder up staircases, the clouds which move in slow procession through the upper halls. On Tuesdays and Fridays, Piranesi sees his friend, the other, and other times he brings tributes of food and water lilies to the dead. But mostly he is alone. Messages begin to appear, scratched out in chalk on the pavements. There is something new in the house, but who are they and what do they want? Are they a friend, or do they bring destruction and madness, as the other claims? Lost texts must be found, secrets must be uncovered. The world that Piranesi thought he knew is becoming strange and dangerous. The beauty of the house is immeasurable, its kindness infinite.
This sounds like a mythological, fairy tale-esque, folkloric romp. Would I be right in thinking that?
Yes, you would be right. Well done. So this book is, I'm sure I've told you this before, but my favourite type of fiction is when lonely people go to the shops. Like, there has to be a scene in everything I read or watch where someone lonely goes to the shops. I like things set in the real world with usually unpleasant lonely people. But this was, so Pooh and Essie was a book that I wouldn't normally have read. Mm-hmm. I don't normally enjoy things, or actually haven't pushed myself to read anything that has a sort of magic realism. I think I'm not sure how it's described, how the genre is described actually, but I'm so glad that I read this. It's so, I can totally see why it won. It's just, it's like, there's a, it's like all the other books were set in the world, and then this one is set on a cloud. Like, it's not actually set on a cloud, it's set in a house, but it feels it's in a different league genre-wise to the other books. And I'm so glad that I read it. I haven't read Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell. I haven't read that, and I'm now very tempted to read it just because I love the way that she writes. It was brilliant. It's really like, the picture that I have of it in my head is very vivid, and I'm so pleased that I went beyond my comfort zone, and it's made me want to push that comfort zone a bit further, because I'm very aware of the kind of books that I love, and I do tend to stick within that genre.
Yeah, I can see on the cover that Madeline Miller, who writes wonderful kind of mythic folkloric books, has endorsed it. And I completely agree. I very much often find myself reading in the real world, because I just always have. I like realism, but actually, yeah, you know, being taken out of your comfort zone as a reader is one of the reasons why books are so wonderful and why we all love them, because they push you beyond what you think you know and what you think you like. So, Laura, if you were the sole judge of the Women's Prize for Fiction 2021, and let's pretend for a minute you are. And
my gosh, I feel so powerful.
Let's go in order from 3 to 1. What would be third place for you?
Third place would be Pooh and Essie.
Nice. Okay, so we're moving first to third, but she still makes the cut. Excellent. Yeah. And how about number two?
Number two would be The Vanishing Half.
Okay, excellent. I'm really glad that made the top three. And what about number one?
Unsettled Ground.
Amazing. So Claire Fuller is your winner.
I loved it. I just loved it. I was sad when it finished. I sat, 3 cold baths that were warm when I started.
And if that is a reason to get your head stuck into that book, I can't think of another one. Laura, thank you so much for joining us. What are you working on yourself at the moment in Brighton?
Well, I am preparing actually at the moment for a show I'm doing at the Old Royal Naval College in London. I've been commissioned to make a show where I walk the grounds with 5 people who are involved in that community in Greenwich. And I'm going to weave a show together based on their stories. And then we have a silent disco at the end. So I'm taking the audience on that same walk with a silent disco. And I talk about the conversations that I had with those original 5 walkers. That's on the 9th and 10th of October at the Old Royal Naval College.
As ever, the work that you do sounds completely fascinating and completely above my head. I would love to know what you're reading at the moment. And I'm very happy to exclusively announce that our next book club book is finally Evie Wilde's Bass Rock.
Oh, I love that book. I loved it.
And I'm really, really excited to read it. I've just started it and I think it's absolutely wonderful.
It's brilliant. Yeah, I'm really glad you're reading it. It's great. Let's chat about it.
Absolutely. And what are you reading at the moment?
Oh, like a massive cliche, I'm reading Sally Rooney.
Oh, okay. Well, what do you think?
I mean, I do feel like this is a controversial opinion. I like Sally Rooney, but I'm not like totally bowled over. Like, I finish her books and I go, yes, that was a good book. I enjoyed it. But I think I felt, I more felt the pressure to read it. Like, I want to read it so I can understand the discourse around it. Yes, it's good. I'm only about 50 pages in, so I'm not very far in. But one of the best things I've read this year is Sunset by Jessie Cave.
I have just finished that myself.
So good.
It was completely and utterly heartbreaking, tragic, affirming, all the things that it says it is on the cover.
Right.
I often don't agree with, and I thought, I'm so glad that you agree, Laura. I think it's a really, really amazing exploration of grief and loneliness and redemption and London, and I just loved it.
It makes me want to go to Costa Coffee in an airport just to kind of, which just no book has ever made me want to do before.
I know exactly what you mean. So for anyone listening that sounds like they may be interested in it, the premise is, and this is no spoilers, that a tragic incident occurs at the beginning of the book between these two sisters who are close in age, very different as people, but very, very close as, you know, best friends, really. There's a tragic incident. And the book follows the main character, Ruth, as she basically has to learn to live in a world without her sister and navigate a life that she never planned to live without her. And it's really deeply moving and beautifully written and tragic and funny and very human, and written by Jessie Cave, who you may remember as she's a comedian but also was an actor in Harry Potter.
She's incredible, actually. She's also an artist. She does some really beautiful artwork. She calls them her doodles, but they that's doing them a disservice, really. But I just loved it. I couldn't wait to recommend it to people when I'd finished it.
Absolutely, me too. So I'm really glad that we discovered that. Completely unrehearsed material there. Laura, thank you so much for coming.
You're so welcome. See you again soon.
Welcome, Zara Slattery, to the Brighton Book Club. Can you introduce yourself?
Hello, my name is Zara. I'm a illustrator, graphic novelist and art tutor.
And you are based in Brighton, and there is a really big comics and graphics novel scene in Brighton, is that right?
There is, yes. It's a very lovely one.
Who is some of your favourite Brighton-based graphic novelists?
Oh my goodness. Well, I'd have to list them all, because I wouldn't want to miss anyone out. So of course there's Hannah Berry, there's Hannah Eaton, there's Joe Deasy, there's Danny Noble, Daniel Locke, and I call them my comics compadres. There's Mifanwi Tristram, who's just an amazing book on protest, and there's Michi Mathias, got amazing vegan recipe cards coming out, and Simon Russell, who's really good, is the go-to when we want some like graphics advice, and many others that I've just not included.
So your first graphic novel, if I'm right, Coma, is out now with local publisher Myriad Editions. What is it about?
So Coma is about the 15-day medically induced coma I experienced in 2013. So in 2013, I lost my right leg and glute muscle to a deadly bacterial infection called necrotizing myositis, commonly known as the flesh-eating bug. And so Coma documents the coma, the 15 days I had with hallucinations and altered reality. But it's also accompanied by my husband's diary that he kept at the time.
Why did you decide, Zara, to put such a kind of difficult time of your life onto the paper?
Fascination, really. It was something I knew pretty early on that I was going to write, draw about, had to get to the right headspace to do it. I just thought it was really interesting. You know, the things I'd sort of discovered about it and the things I might discover about the experience through writing and drawing it.
So in Coma, which is beautiful, by the way, congratulations.
Thank you.
The sections told from your husband's point of view, which, if I'm right, are taken from his diaries from the time, and the sections from your point of view are in colour and his are in black and white. What made you decide to have this kind of creative difference? Because they're also in a different medium, but I don't know enough about art, so you'll have to tell me about that.
So on one level, it's pretty practical. You know, Dan's diary pages talk about, you know, our home, the kitchen, people coming, him traveling around Brighton, being in the hospital. And, you know, I just needed a simple drawing style to put all that information in. So I wasn't going to get sort of like lost too much in it. So I knew I was going to do it in quite simple line. The line I chose, or the medium I chose, was charcoal. And I chose that because I thought it was just held the emotional weight of his words. It's quite a primal, quite a simple drawing material, quite emotional, I feel. And that allowed me to get in and, I feel, give it his words an authentic visual voice. my pages, the coma pages, are drawn with brush pen and walnut ink and then coloured in Photoshop. And they take their colours, the inspiration for their colours, from medieval manuscripts, because one of the earliest hallucinations I had was of a medieval skeleton. And I also felt that I'd been through a purgatory of sorts.
I'd love to know more about the research that you've done, because I know that you work quite closely with Brighton and Sussex Surrey Medical School, and the research that you did into what happens when you're in a coma and what are these hallucinations all about?
So really, you know, initially I just wanted to document my experience, pretty blind really, without doing very much research, because I wanted just to not be distracted by other people's experiences. It was only when I was writing and drawing that I realized that they related to other underworld myths, that there were similarities. And then I thought, well, mine was about simple language and I guess a visual translation of simple language. And it was through that that I thought, okay, so this is how it possibly connects to myths. Maybe we've, you know, just absorb them in stories and, you know, everyday language. When it came to the medical school, you know, I just went and had a conversation with them and we sat down and somebody from the ICU just did a map of where I possibly was in the ward, what would be around my bed, you know, where, you know, the wires would go. So I would be pointing to sort of like different scars on my neck and my sort of like upper chest and go, well, what went here? And what was this that went there? So that was just really interesting to be given a breakdown. An expert view of the reasons for my scars.
And did you remember all of these really vividly? Because they are such vivid images in the book. They must have stayed in your mind really clearly.
Yeah, they did. You know, it's quite interesting that, you know, most people who have a medically induced coma will say that it's a lived experience and it's not something you forget. So like a dream that sort of could fade over time. This is really vivid and really strong. And it's like the emotions you feel and the things you see feel like they could have happened yesterday. So it's not a difficult thing to recall. It's just very present.
Was there a sense of catharsis in visually representing what happened to you during those 15 days?
I sort of like waited till I was pretty much healed emotionally. You know, I watched trash for several years to heal. That was cathartic. This was my creative self. You know, I'm giving time for my creative self. So it wasn't so much cathartic. It revealed things and it was useful.
There's a lot in coma about the importance of diaries and taking note of what happens around us. And at the end of the book, you've got these lovely letters from the nurses who looked after you and from your children. And obviously a big part of the book is your husband Dan's diary. Are you a big advocate for diary writing and recording our everyday lives?
I guess I am. I don't do it myself. And actually, in my recovery in my rehab, I pointedly did not record it because that was quite an awful experience and I didn't want to ever recall it. Having said that, during the time, I feel Dan was so brave in keeping a diary of my experience and his experience, because it has enabled me to make sense of it and heal emotionally as well as physically. So yeah, massive advocate. And also for patient diaries, just so helpful. And I think, you know, medical staff need to be as honest as possible. It doesn't matter kind of like how hard it is to read it. There'll be a point when you're actually strong enough to read it and to actually fully understand what's happened to you and your body. Yeah, absolutely. I think diaries are essential.
Why do you think that graphic novels are really good at portraying kind of really difficult experiences? I'm thinking about other ones I've read, like Billy, Me and You by Nicola Streeton, which is one of my favourites, and even Shame Pudding by Danny Noble. You know,
I love that too.
We had her on a few couple of months ago. So why do you think that the kind of graphic novel format can be really good for difficult experiences?
Gosh, why is it really good? Well, I just, I suppose I'm so embedded in it. I just think it's such a wonderfully generous emotional tool. I think there's an alchemy that happens when you put words and pictures together. I think it's able to go to places, reveal something in that space in between that I'm not sure if just prose can do alone. I mean, prose can, but the thing with a graphic novel, you can zoom through, you know, quite a complex subject in a couple of hours, but then you just go back and back and it reveals something again and again. And I think, you know, there's sort of like deeper layers that you can sort of tap into. So I think it's something you can read. Yeah, definitely on lots of different layers. You can just skim the surface and you'll get a really good overview. And then you can go back in and you pick up the colours, you pick up the line, you pick up the space in between things, you pick up how the panels are used. And you're just sort of, you get an emotional connection with the images as well as the words.
That is such a great way to kind of encourage people to read graphic novels too, that there's something that you can keep returning to. For anyone that hasn't read a graphic novel before or thinks they might be interested in starting them, do you have anything you'd recommend as kind of good gateway ones?
Oh my goodness, crikey. I first read American Born Chinese by Jean Luen Yang. That was the first graphic novel I read, and I was just blown away because there's lots of amazing story strands that came together, and I was like, "Wow, that's fantastic." Any of the Brighton comic creators, Shane Pudding is amazing. Crikey, I'm a great fan of Alexis Deakin. It's a little bit fantasy, and his book Gesh, spelt G-E-I-S, that is a trilogy. The third book's coming out soon. That just takes you away to another place. It's quite magical. I love the style of that. I love Gillian Tamaki, just beautiful drawing style and great storytelling. Crikey. Yeah, I go to the library and have a good look because there's something there for everyone. Not just, you know, obviously the superheroes, but there's something else too.
Sarah, thank you so much again for coming on. How can we find and follow you and see your work and buy a copy of Coma?
Oh, yes, please. Everyone buy a copy of Coma. Because it's not just magical. It's about life as well. So on Instagram, I'm Zora Slattery, one word. On Twitter, I'm Ink Splattery. And my website is zoraslattery.com.
Heidi James is the Brighton-based author of four books: The Sound Mirror, So the Doves, the novella The Mesmerist Daughter, and her debut novel Wounding is this month's book club book. Wounding was written in 2014 and published by Blue Moose Books. Here is the blurb. Cora has everything a woman is supposed to want: a career, a caring husband, children, and a stylish home. Desperate for release and burdened with guilt, she falls into a pattern of ever-increasing violence and sexual degradation until a one-night stand tips her over the edge and she finds herself in a dominatrix dungeon. Wounding explores a woman's search for redemption, identity, and truth. This is such a powerful novel, I thought. It explores isolation and marriage and expectation and identity really beautifully, and in quite a short amount of pages. It's only just under 200 pages long. This is not a book to skim read. It's one of those ones to savour and to get immersed in. James writes searing prose and really, really complex characters. I would not say that this is an easy read by any means, but it's certainly really an important one. And I'm really glad that the author, Heidi James, is joining us in the Brighton Book Club studio today to talk about the book. Welcome, Heidi.
Hi, thank you very much. Hello.
Can you tell us a bit about yourself?
Oh gosh, that's such a question, isn't it? So what can I tell you about me that is relatively pertinent to this conversation? I am a mother, a very, very lucky mum of two beautiful, beautiful children and one lovely stepdaughter. I grew up in Kent before moving to London and then here into Sussex. And I had a really difficult relationship with my mum, and that informs quite a lot of my work, just not just as excoriating and trying to exorcise all of that, but to understand it and to understand my mum. And I just think, as a writer, what I'm really interested in is relationships. And I know everyone will say that, but the complexity and how difficult love can be. And even when a relationship isn't always positive, when it could be quite toxic, often that toxicity is driven by profound and complicated love. And so a lot of my work deals with that, really. And so conversely, I'm quite boring and have really lovely, healthy, fairly ordinary blessings of family and stuff, which I'm very grateful for and understand is lucky from where I've come from. But that drove me to create actually a drama-free, fairly ordinary life from which I can then explore my sort of ideas in fiction.
So Wounding is your first novel, and you wrote it quite a long time ago in 2014. So I know that this isn't going to be very easy to ask you, you know, tell me about your process. But do you remember when you first started writing it and why you decided to do that?
Yeah, it's probably even longer than it was published in 2014. So I'd have been writing it even, you know, longer ago. But what I really wanted to do was understand and be sympathetic to, without being sentimental or making excuses for, relationships or, and particularly, you know, stereotypes about parenting, and understand why it's very difficult sometimes for people to fulfill society's expectations, and to do, but to do that without creating monsters. And I did a lot of work and research into trauma theory, and I read lots of lots of work on mothering, and also thinking about Judith Butler's ideas about gender and performativity. And there's lots of that echoing through this novel. I really just wanted to get under the skin of these expectations and how they can be tyrannous and unfair.
Absolutely. And you do it so beautifully. So this book is told from two perspectives, the husband and the wife. So the it's told in the first person from the husband. So, and it kind of in almost like a letter form, him talking to the wife who perhaps isn't listening or might not read whatever he's writing. And you chose to write in the close third person for Cora. Mm. I was wondering why you decided to write them in this way.
I wanted to take away her voice, because that's often what happens in society to women, that they're not really heard. So there's sort of structure, there's sort of elements of that. So it's representing something in society and him being heard and also feeling he has a right to speak. I think that's quite crucial. But by the same token, he's not the villain. Neither of them are. It's not being able to communicate clearly, I think, and not listening to each other. That's the problem throughout all of this, and understand, I'm sort of trying to comply with expectations. But he isn't named, which I thought was quite interesting, because that's sort of, that's another way of robbing him of some sort of agency or identifier. But also to write Cora, and this is really just about craft and undoes that sort of mystery, I think, is to get that close to a character, but really examine them. I find the close third person much easier than first. I find the first person by nature, by its definition, is self-conscious and quite difficult. Who really examines themselves properly without self, you know, creating a myth or anything? So I wanted to be able to have almost a cool look at her, and I could do that with the close third person.
So much about Wounding is about expectation of women and also mental health. Now, postnatal depression was only really mentioned once in the book, but was this something that you did self-consciously to kind of never really name what was happening with Cora?
That's precisely it. Yeah, I thought that was almost too easy a get out, but I think what she is suffering from is postnatal depression alongside other issues. I mean, there's stuff with her dad that goes on that I sort of hint at, but I don't overlabor things with her own mother. Mm-hmm. But in class, but I think it can be, I think, someone who suffered with mental health issues, it's really useful to be able to name what's going on, find help. But the opposite of that can be, it can be very reductive. Oh, you're just suffering from, oh, it's just this. Nothing is just anything. And, you know, these issues have many causes and can come from very many different places. So I just think I didn't want to sort of reduce it down to one single idea of it's postnatal depression.
Mm-hmm.
Often as well, that, as with all mental health issues, these different challenges can present in very many different ways. And I think we can have expectations again around what postnatal depression or a personality disorder might look like. And it can defy those categories. And that's what I was trying to do.
Heidi, please can you read some for us? And I'm going to ask you to just read the first paragraph because we're running a bit short on time and I don't want to miss out on my last questions.
Of course. Cora steps down from the train. It's a long drop between the train and the platform, but she doesn't stumble. She yields to the flow of other bodies, pushing her towards the exit and the ticket barriers with the usual staff leaning against the wall. She presses her card against the reader and the gates open for her like blunt scissors. Outside, it's still hot and light, despite being early evening. Taxis queue around the corner, waiting for the tired, the lazy, and the lost. She walks past them, the slamming doors and the destinations, the meters set to clock the distance, the rolled up tabloids on the dashboard, the shiny shoes and loosened ties of office workers.
Your prose, Heidi, is so, so beautiful. And I would love to take this opportunity for you to tell us a bit about the other books that you've written. So people that enjoyed this and Wounding might want to read some of your other books. So you started off with a novella, The Mesmerist Daughter. What's this about?
The Mesmerist Daughter is going to sound really like, oh, Heidi, you're really mining the same scene. But The Mesmerist Daughter is about a little girl who believes her mother is a wolf, quite literally, and that she puts on a lady skin every single day and hides her wolfishness, like pushes back the muzzle and pulls on this rubber lady suit in order to convince and mesmerize the world around her that she's not this dark and demonic, monstrous mother.
And your second book, So the Doves, this is a crime novel, right?
Yeah, so I think someone's described it as a literary crime novel. I really like playing with what I do and not sort of sticking to the same genre and things. So it's very different to Wounding. It does use the genre of crime, but it's really exploring friendship and love and also, you know, society and the secrets that are kept from all of us, and this kind of cultural hegemonies and how we understand the truth. Ultimately, that's what So the Doves is about, how we understand ourselves and the truth.
And The Sound Mirror, your fabulous recent book. Can you tell us about this one?
Well, this one returns back to mothers, but it's told across three generations. And it's about how history and politics and the outside imposes and presses in on us and the damage we might do, but also those beautiful connections of love that rescue us and mend us in a way.
Heidi, thank you so much for coming on the show today. How can we find and follow you and pick up a copy of one of your books?
I'm on Twitter and Instagram. I love Instagram. It feels so much more gentler and a real celebration. And my handle on there is @HeidiPearlJames, and that's for both. I do have a website, but I don't blog very much or anything on that. And books are available. There's the wonderful The Bookmakers in Brighton, which I'm part of that wonderful collective and idea. And you know, Waterstones, all the other good bookshops, all the indies, and of course, you know, the online big retailers too.
Huge thank you to Nigel Stewart for sponsoring this episode of the Brighton Book Club. Nigel is an author from Lancashire whose recent book, The Lines Between Lies, is out now. You can follow him on Twitter @MeNigelStew. Our next book club book is Bass Rock by Evie Wilde, out now. The book club is also available as a podcast where you can download from wherever you get yours. You can get in touch with us on Instagram at BTM Book Club and email us at btmbookclub@gmail.com. If you're interested in being featured on the book club or if you're interested in sponsoring an episode, get in touch. We'll see you next month. Pressure.